The Third Eye by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend. Chapter 8, The Patala. One Monday morning, the Lama Mingyar Dondup told me that the date for our visit to the Patala had been fixed. It was to be at the end of the week. "We must rehearse," Lobsang. "We must make ourselves quite perfect in our approach." I was going to be presented to the Dalai Lama, and my approach had to be exactly right. In a little disused temple near our schoolroom, there was a life-size statue of the Dalai Lama. We went there and pretended that we were in audience at the Patala. "You see how I do it first," Lobsang. "Enter the room like this, with your eyes down. Walk to here, about 5 feet from the Dalai Lama. Put out your tongue in salute and sink to your knees. Now watch carefully. Put your arms like this and bow forward. Once more, and then a third time. Kneel with your head bowed, then place the silk scarf across his feet like this. Regain your position with head bowed so that he can put a scarf across your neck. Count 10 to yourself so as not to show undue haste. Then rise and walk backwards to the nearest unoccupied cushion." I had followed all that, as the Lama demonstrated it with the ease of long practice. He continued, "Just a warning here. Before you start to walk backwards, take a quick, unobtrusive glance at the position of the nearest cushion. We don't want you to catch the cushion with your heels and have to practice a breakfall to save the back of your head. It is quite easy to trip in the excitement of the moment. Now, you show me that you can do as well as I." I went out of the room, and the Lama clapped his hands as a signal for me to enter. In I hurried, only to be stopped with, "Lobsang, Lobsang, are you in for a race? Now do it more slowly. Time your steps by saying to yourself, 'Om Mani Padme Hum.' Then you will come in as a dignified young priest instead of a galloping racehorse on the Sangpo Plain." Out I went once more, and this time I entered most sedately and made my way to the statue. On my knees I went, with my tongue protruding in Tibetan salute. My three bows must have been models of perfection. I was proud of them. But goodness me, I'd forgotten the scarf. So, out I went once more to start all over again. This time I did it correctly and placed the ceremonial scarf at the foot of the statue. I walked backwards and managed to sit in the lotus fashion without tripping. Now we come to the next stage. You will have to conceal your wooden drinking cup in your left sleeve. You will be given tea when you are seated. The cup is held like this, wedged against the sleeve and forearm. If you are reasonably careful, it will stay in place. Let us practice with the cup up the sleeve and remembering the scarf. Every morning of that week we rehearsed so that I could do it automatically. At first, the cup would fall out and clatter across the floor when I bowed, but I soon mastered the knack of it. On the Friday, I had to go before the Lord Abbot and show him that I was proficient. He said that my performance was a worthy tribute to the training of our brother Mingyar Dondup. The next morning, Saturday, we walked down our hill to go across to the Potala. Our lamasery was a part of the Potala organization, although it was on a separate hill, close to the main buildings. Ours was known as the Temple of Medicine and the Medical School. Our Lord Abbot was the sole physician to the Dalai Lama, a position not altogether to be envied because his job was not to cure an illness, but to keep the patient well. Any aches or disorders were thus considered to be due to some failure on the part of the physician. Yet the Lord Abbot could not go and examine the Dalai Lama whenever he wished, but had to wait until he was sent for when the patient was ill. But on this Saturday, I was not thinking of the worries of the physician. I had enough of my own. At the foot of our hill, we turned towards the Potala and made our way through the crowds of avid sightseers and pilgrims. These people had come from all parts of Tibet to see the home of the Inmost One, as we call the Dalai Lama. If they could catch a glimpse of him, they would go away feeling more than repaid for the long journeys and hardships. Some of the pilgrims had traveled for months on foot to make this one visit to the Holy of Holies. Here there were farmers, nobles from distant provinces, herdsmen, traders, and the sick who hoped to obtain a cure in Lhasa. All thronged the road and made the 6-mile circuit around the foot of the Potala. Some went on hands and knees, others stretched their length on the ground, arose and stretched again. Yet others, the sick and the infirm, hobbled along, supported by friends, or with the aid of 2 sticks. Everywhere there were vendors. Some were selling hot buttered tea heated over a swinging brazier. Others were selling food of various kinds. There were charms for sale and amulets blessed by a holy incarnation. Old men were there selling printed horoscopes to the gullible. Farther down the road, a group of cheerful men were trying to sell hand prayer wheels as a souvenir of the Potala. Scribes were there too. For a certain sum, they would write a note certifying that the person paying them had visited Lhasa and all the holy places there. We had no time for any of these. Our objective was the Potala. The private residence of the Dalai Lama was at the very top of the building, for no one may live higher. An immense stone staircase goes all the way up to the top, running outside the buildings. It is more like a street of stairs than a mere staircase. Many of the higher officials ride their horses up to save them from walking. We met many such during our ascent. At one point, high up, the Lama Mingyar Dondup stopped and pointed. "There is your former home," Lob sang. "The servants are very active in the courtyard." I looked, and perhaps it would be better to leave unsaid what I felt. Mother was just riding out with her retinue of servants. Tzu was there as well. No, my thoughts at that time must remain mine. The Potala is a self-contained township on a small mountain. Here are conducted all the ecclesiastical and secular affairs of Tibet. This building, or group of buildings, is the living heart of the country, the focus of all thoughts, of all hopes. Within these walls are treasure houses containing blocks of gold, sacks and sacks of gems, and curiosities from the earliest ages. The present buildings are only about 350 years old, but they are built on the foundations of a former palace. Long before that, there was an armored fort on the top of the mountain. Deep down inside the mountain, for it is of volcanic origin, there is a huge cave with passages radiating from it, and at the end of one, a lake. Only a few, the very privileged few, have been here or even know about it. But outside in the morning sunlight, we were making our way up the steps. Everywhere we heard the clacking of prayer wheels, the only form of wheel in Tibet, because of the old prediction which says that when wheels come into the country, peace will go out. Eventually, we reached the top where the giant guards swung open the gold gate as they saw the Lama Mingyar Dondup, whom they knew well. We went on until we reached the very top of the roof, where there were tombs of former incarnations of the Dalai Lama and his present private residence. A large curtain of yak's wool, colored maroon, covered the entrance. It was pulled aside at our approach, and we entered a large hall, which was guarded by green porcelain dragons. Many rich tapestries hung from the walls, depicting religious scenes and ancient legends. On low tables there were articles to delight a collector's heart, statuettes of various gods and goddesses of mythology, and cloisonné ornaments. By a curtain doorway on a shelf rested the Book of Nobles, and I wished that I could open it and see our name inside to reassure me, for on this day in this place I felt very small and insignificant. At 8 years of age I had no illusions left, and I wondered why the highest in the land wanted to see me. I knew that it was highly unusual, and it was my opinion that there was more hard work behind it all, hard work or hardship. A lama, robed in cherry red, with a gold stole around his neck, was talking with the Lama Mingyar Dondup. The latter seemed to be very well known indeed here, and everywhere I had been with him, I heard, "His Holiness is interested and wants a private talk with him alone." My guide turned to me and said, "It is time for you to go in, Lobsang. I will show you the door, and then enter alone and pretend that it is just practice again, as we have been doing all week." He put an arm around my shoulders and led me to a door, whispering, "There is no need at all for you to worry. In you go." With a little push at my back to urge me in, he stood and watched. I entered the door, and there at the far end of a long room was the inmost one, the 13th Dalai Lama. He was sitting on a silken cushion of saffron color. His dress was that of an ordinary lama, but on his head he wore a tall yellow hat which had flaps reaching to his shoulders. He was just putting a book down. Bowing my head, I walked across the floor until I was about 5 feet away. Then I sank to my knees and bowed three times. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, had passed me the silk scarf just before I entered. Now I placed it at the feet of the inmost one. He bent forward and put his across my wrists instead of, as usual, around the neck. I felt dismayed now. I had to walk backwards to the nearest cushion, and I had observed that they were all quite a distance away, near the walls. The Dalai Lama spoke for the first time. "Those cushions are too far away for you to walk backwards, so turn around and bring one here so that we can talk together." I did so, and returned with a cushion. He said, "Put it here in front of me and sit down." When I was seated, he said, "Now, young man, I have heard some remarkable things about you. You are clairvoyant in your own right, and you have had the power further increased by the opening of the third eye. I have the records of your last incarnation. I have also the astrologer's predictions. You will have a hard time at the start, but will attain success in the end. You will go to many foreign countries the world over, countries of which you have not yet heard. You will see death and destruction and cruelty such as you cannot imagine. The way will be long and hard, but success will come, as predicted." I did not know why he was telling me all this. I knew it all, every word of it, and had done since I was 7 years of age. I knew well that I would learn medicine and surgery in Tibet, and then go to China and learn the same subjects all over again. But the inmost one was still speaking, warning me not to give proof of any unusual powers, not to talk of the ego or soul when I was in the Western world. "I have been to India and China," he said, "and in those countries one can discuss the greater realities. But I have met many from the West. Their values are not as ours. They worship commerce and gold. Their scientists say, 'Show us the soul. Produce it. Let us grasp it, weigh it, test it with acids. Tell us its molecular structure, its chemical reactions. Proof, proof, we must have proof.' They will tell you, uncaring that their negative attitude of suspicion kills any chance of their obtaining that proof. But we must have tea." He lightly struck a gong and gave an order to the Lama, who answered it. Shortly, the latter returned, bringing tea and special foods which had been imported from India. As we ate, the inmost one talked, telling me of India and China. He told me that he wanted me to study really hard and that he would pick special teachers for me. I simply could not contain myself, and I blurted out, "Oh, no one can know more than my master, the Lama Mingyar Dondup." The Dalai Lama looked at me, then put his head back and roared with laughter. Probably no other person had spoken to him like that. Certainly no other 8-year-old boy had. He seemed to appreciate it. "So, you think Mingyar Dondup is good, do you? Tell me what you really think of him, you young gamecock." "Sir," I replied, "you have told me that I have exceptional powers of clairvoyance. The Lama Mingyar Dondup is the best person I have ever seen." The Dalai Lama laughed again and struck the gong at his side. "Ask Mingyar to come in," he said to the Lama, who answered his summons. The Lama, Mingyur Dondup, entered and made his bows to the inmost one. "Bring a cushion and sit down, Mingyur," said the Dalai Lama. "You have had your character told by this young man of yours. It is an assessment with which I entirely agree." The Lama, Mingyur Dondup, sat down beside me, and the Dalai Lama continued. "You have accepted full responsibility for Lobsang Rampa's training. Plan it as you will, and call upon me for any letters of authority. I will see him from time to time." Turning to me, he said, "Young man, you have chosen well. Your guide is an old friend of my former days, and is a true master of the occult." There were a few more words, and then we rose, bowed, and left the room. I could see that the Lama, Mingyur Dondup, was secretly very pleased with me, or with the impression I had made. "We will stay here for a few days and explore some of the lesser-known parts of the buildings," he said. "Some of the lower corridors and rooms have not been opened during the past 200 years. You will learn much Tibetan history from these rooms." One of the attendant lamas, there were none below that rank in the Dalai Lama's residence, approached and said that we should have a room each here at the top of the building. He showed us to the rooms, and I was quite thrilled at the view, right across Lhasa, right across the plain. The Lama said, "His Holiness has given instruction that you come and go as you please, and that no door be closed against you." The Lama, Mingyur Dondup, told me that I should lie down for a time. The scar on my left leg was still causing much trouble. It was painful, and I walked with a limp. At one time it was feared that I would be a permanent cripple. For an hour I rested. Then my guide came in, bearing tea and food. "Time to fill out some of those hollows," Lobsang. "They eat well in this place, so let us make the most of it." I needed no further encouragement to eat. When we had finished, the Lama, Mingyur Dondup, led the way out of the room, and we went into another room at the far side of the flat roof. Here, to my profound amazement, the windows had no oiled cloth, but they were filled with nothingness, which was just visible. I put out my hand and very cautiously touched the visible nothingness. To my astonishment, it was cold as ice, and slippery. And then it dawned upon me, glass! I had never seen the stuff in a sheet before. We had used powdered glass on our kite strings, but that glass had been thick, and one could not see clearly through it. It had been colored, but this was like water. But that was not all. The Lama, Mingyur Dondup, swung open the window and picked up a brass tube which seemed to be part of a trumpet covered in leather. He took the tube and pulled, and 4 pieces appeared, each from inside the other. He laughed at the expression on my face, and then poked one end of the tube out of the window and brought the other end close to his face. "Ah," I thought, "he is going to play an instrument." But the end did not go to his mouth, but to his eye. He fiddled about with the tube and then said, "Look through here, Lobsang. Look with your right eye and keep the left closed." I looked and nearly fainted with stupefaction. A man on a horse was riding up the tube towards me. I jumped aside and looked around. There was no one in the room except the Lama, Mingyar Dondup, and he was shaking with laughter. I looked at him suspiciously, thinking that he had bewitched me. His Holiness said you were a master of the occult, but do you have to make fun of your pupil? I said. He laughed all the more and motioned for me to look again. With considerable misgivings, I did so, and my guide moved the tube slightly so that I saw a different view. A telescope! Never before had I seen one. Never have I forgotten the sight of a man on a horse riding up inside the tube towards me. I am often reminded of it when a Western person says, "Impossible," to some statement about the occult. That was certainly impossible to me. The Dalai Lama had brought a number of telescopes with him when he returned from India, and he was very fond of looking over the surrounding countryside. Here, too, I looked into a mirror for the first time, and I certainly did not recognize the horrible-looking creature that I saw. I saw a pale-faced little boy who had a large red scar in the middle of his forehead and a nose which was undeniably prominent. I had seen my faint reflection before in water, but this was too plain. I have not bothered with mirrors since. It may be thought that Tibet was a peculiar country to be without glass, telescopes, or mirrors, but people did not want such things, nor did we want wheels. Wheels made for speed and for so-called civilization. We have long realized that in the rush of commercial life, there is no time for the things of the mind. Our physical world had proceeded at a leisurely pace, so that our esoteric knowledge could grow and expand. We have, for thousands of years, known the truth of clairvoyance, telepathy, and other branches of metaphysics. While it is quite true that many lamas can sit naked in the snow and by thought alone melt the snow around them, such things are not demonstrated for the delight of the mere sensation seeker. Some lamas, who are masters of the occult, definitely can levitate, but they do not display their powers to entertain naive onlookers. The teacher in Tibet always makes sure that his pupil is morally fit to be trusted with such powers. It follows from this that as the teacher must be absolutely sure of the moral integrity of the student, metaphysical powers are never abused, as only the right people are taught. These powers are in no way magical. They are merely the outcome of using natural laws. In Tibet, there are some who can best develop in company, and others who have to retire to solitude. These latter men go to outlying lamaseries and enter a hermit's cell. It is a small room, usually built on the side of a mountain. The stone walls are thick, perhaps 6 feet thick, so that no sound can penetrate. The hermit enters at his own desire, and the entrance is walled up. There is no light whatever, no furnishings, nothing but that empty stone box. Food is passed in once a day through a light-trapped, sound-proofed hatch. Here the hermit stays, first for 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days. He meditates on the nature of life and on the nature of man. For no reason whatever Can he leave that cell in the physical body? During the last month of his stay, a very small hole is made in the roof to allow a faint ray of light to enter. It is enlarged day by day so that the hermit's eyes become used to the light once again. Otherwise, he would go blind as soon as he emerged. Very often, these men return to their cell after only a few weeks and stay there for life. It is not such a sterile, worthless existence as one might suppose. Man is a spirit, a creature of another world, and once he becomes free of the bonds of the flesh, he can roam the world as a spirit and can help by thought. Thoughts, as we in Tibet well know, are waves of energy. Matter is energy condensed. It is thought, carefully directed and partly condensed, which can cause an object to move by thought. Thought, controlled in another way, can result in telepathy and can cause a person at a distance to do a certain action. Is this so very difficult to believe in a world which regards as commonplace the act of a man speaking into a microphone, guiding a plane to land in dense fog when the pilot can see no ground at all? With a little training and no skepticism, man could do this by telepathy instead of making use of a fallible machine. My own esoteric development did not entail this prolonged seclusion in total darkness. It took another form, which is not available to the larger number of men who want to become hermits. My training was directed towards a specific purpose, and by direct order of the Dalai Lama. I was taught such things by another method, as well as by hypnosis, which cannot be discussed in a book of this nature. It will suffice to state that I was given more enlightenment than the average hermit can obtain in a very long lifetime. My visit to the Patala was in connection with the first stages of this training, but more of that later. I was fascinated by that telescope, and I used it quite a lot to examine the places I knew so well. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, explained the principles in minute detail so that I could understand that there was no magic involved, but just ordinary laws of nature. Everything was explained, not merely about the telescope, but lessons were given as to why a certain thing happened. I could never say, "Oh, it's magic," without having an explanation of the laws involved. Once, during this visit, I was taken to a perfectly dark room. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, said, "Now you stand here, Lobsang, and watch that white wall." Then he blew out the flame of the butter lamp and did something to the shutter of the window. Instantly, there appeared on the wall before me a picture of Lhasa, but upside down. I shouted with amazement at the sight of men, women, and yaks walking about upside down. The picture suddenly flickered, and everything was right way up. The explanation about bending light rays really puzzled me more than anything. How could one bend light? I had demonstrated to me the method of breaking jars and pictures with a soundless whistle, and that was quite simple and not worth a further thought. But bending light? Not until a special piece of apparatus, consisting of a lamp, the light of which was hidden by various slats, was brought from another room, could I understand the matter. Then I could see the rays bend, and nothing surprised me after. The storerooms of the Patala were crammed full of wonderful statues, ancient books, and most beautiful wall paintings of religious subjects, the very, very few Western people who have seen any of them consider them to be indecent. They portray a male and female spirit in close embrace, but the intention of these pictures is very far from being obscene, and no Tibetan would ever regard them as such. These two nude figures in embrace are meant to convey the ecstasy which follows the union of knowledge and right living. I admit that I was horrified beyond measure when I first saw that the Christians worshipped a tortured man nailed to a cross as their symbol. It is such a pity that we all tend to judge the peoples of other countries by our own standards. For centuries, gifts have been arriving at the Patala from various countries, gifts for the Dalai Lama of the time. Nearly all those presents have been stored in rooms, and I had a wonderful time turning out and obtaining psychometrical impressions as to why the things were sent in the first place. It was indeed an education in motives. Then, after I had stated my impression as obtained from the object, my guide would read from a book and tell me the exact history and what had happened after. I was pleased at his more and more frequent, "You are right, Lobsang. You are doing very well indeed." Before leaving the Patala, we made a visit to one of the underground tunnels. I was told that I could visit just one, as I would see the others at a later date. We took flaring torches and cautiously climbed down what seemed to be endless steps and slithered along smooth, rocky passages. These tunnels, I was told, had been made by volcanic action countless centuries before. On the walls were strange diagrams and drawings of quite unfamiliar scenes. I was more interested in seeing the lake, which I had been told stretched for miles and miles at the end of one passage. At last we entered a tunnel which grew wider and wider until suddenly the roof disappeared to where the light of our torches would not reach. 100 yards more and we stood at the edge of water such as I had never seen before. It was black and still, with the blackness that made it appear almost invisible, more like a bottomless pit than a lake. Not a ripple disturbed the surface, not a sound broke the silence. The rock upon which we stood also was black. It glistened in the light of the torches, but a little to one side was a glitter on the wall. I walked towards it and saw that in the rock there was a broad band of gold that was perhaps 15 to 20 feet long and reached from my neck to my knees. Great heat had once started to melt it from the rock, and it had cooled in lumps like golden candle grease. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, broke the silence. "This lake goes to the river Tsangpo, 40 miles away. Years and years ago, an adventurous party of monks made a raft of wood and made paddles with which to propel it. They stocked the raft with torches and pushed off from the shore. For miles they paddled, exploring, and then they came to an even larger space where they could not see walls or roof. They drifted on as they paddled gently, not sure which way to go. I listened, picturing it vividly. The lama continued. They were lost, not knowing which was forward or which was backward. Suddenly the raft lurched. There was a blast of wind which extinguished their torches, leaving them in complete darkness, and they felt that their fragile craft was in the grip of the water demons. Around they spun, leaving them giddy and sick. They clung to the ropes that held the wood together. With the violent motion, little waves washed over the top, and they became wet through. Their speed increased. They felt they were in the grip of a ruthless giant, pulling them down to their doom. How long they traveled, they had no means of telling. There was no light. The darkness was solid black, such as never was upon the surface of the earth. There was a scraping, grating noise, and stunning blows and crushing pressures. They were flung off the raft and forced under the water. Some of them had just time to gulp air. Others were not so fortunate. Light appeared, greenish and uncertain. It became brighter. They were twisted and thrown. Then they shot up into brilliant sunshine. Two of them managed to reach the shore, more than half drowned, battered and bleeding. Of the other three, there was no trace. For hours they lay between death and life. Eventually, one roused sufficiently to look around him. He nearly collapsed again from the shock. In the distance was the Patala. Around them were green meadows with grazing yaks. At first they thought they had died, and this was a Tibetan heaven. Then they heard footsteps beside them, and a herdsman was looking down at them. He had seen the floating wreckage of the raft, and had come to collect it for his own use. Eventually, the two monks managed to convince the man that they were monks, for their robes had been completely torn off, and he agreed to go to the Patala for litters. Since that day, very little has been done to explore the lake, but it is known that there are islands a little way beyond the range of our torches. One of them has been explored, and what was found you will see later when you were initiated. I thought of it all and wished that I could have raft and explore the lake. My guide had been watching my expression. Suddenly he laughed and said, "Yes, it would be fun to explore. But why waste our bodies when we can do the search in the astral?" "You can," Lob sang. "Within a very few years you will be competent to explore this place with me and add to the knowledge we have of it. But for now, study, boy, study, for both of us." Our torches were flickering low, and it seemed to me that we should soon be groping blindly in the darkness of the tunnels. As we turned away from the lake, I thought how foolish of us not to bring spare lights. At that moment, the Lama Mingyar donned up, turned to the far wall, and felt about. From some hidden niche, he produced more torches and lit them from those almost smoldering out. "We keep spares here," Lob sang, "because it would be difficult to find one's way out in the dark. Now let us be going." Up the sloping passages we toiled, pausing a while to regain our breath and to look at some of the drawings on the wall. I could not understand them. They appeared to be of giants, and there were machines so strange as to be utterly beyond my comprehension. Looking at my guide, I could see that he was quite at home with these drawings and in the tunnels. I was looking forward to other visits here. There was some mystery about it all, and I could never hear of a mystery without trying to get to the bottom of it. I could not bear the idea of spending years guessing at a solution when there was a chance of finding the answer, even if in doing so I was involved in considerable danger. My thoughts were interrupted by, "Lobsang, you are mumbling like an old man. We have a few more steps to go, and then it is daylight again. We will go on the roof and use the telescope to point out the site where those monks of old came to the surface." When we were on the roof, I wondered why we could not ride the 40 miles and actually visit the place. The Lama Mingyar Dondop told me that there was nothing much to see, certainly nothing that the telescope would not reveal. The outlet from the lake was apparently far below the water level, and there was nothing to mark the spot except a clump of trees which had been planted there by order of the previous incarnation of the Dalai Lama. End of chapter 8.